I see you're drinking some of Gretzky's finest.
Well, you know, I just want to support a Canadian entrepreneur.
Folks, welcome back to Michael and Us. I'm Luke Savage.
I'm Will Sloan, folks. And I've got nothing for the introductory segment. I only have so many thoughts. I only have so many ideas. I'm spread very thin these days. But Luke, you said that you had a thought. And perhaps you can present that, and maybe that will lubricate my own thought process and get the gears turning.
Are you spending less time on Twitter right now because you're between jobs?
More time, frankly.
And that's left you with less to say somehow?
I think it's possible that I've maybe like overdosed on having opinions. I feel the market overly saturated with myself.
Maybe it's a bit of an antidote that I have to remain grounded enough, even as I also spend a lot of time on Twitter for work, you know, reading other people's opinions, sharing my own. Maybe it helps that I have to remain grounded enough to develop coherent thoughts in writing. And it's kind of a shield against irony poisoning. I do think in the last few weeks, you've been a bit irony poisoned, although that's not a criticism. I love your Twitter right now.
It's called being Joker-fied. We'll be getting to a character even more twisted, even more fiendish than the Joker. Yes, I refer to Andy Kaufman later on this episode. But before, we would be remiss if we did not take a sideways glance at the U.S. election. The U.S. election, because there's not a lot happening up here in Canada. Everything here in Canada is completely overshadowed. Things seem to be going well for old Team Biden these days. There was a poll out from CNN that had him at 57% nationally, which, you know, we're talking Reagan-Mondale landslide numbers if those hold.
This is a section I guess we're kind of going to be compelled to do almost every episode until the election, which is just some kind of rank punditry about, you know, whatever's happening. The news cycle is so fast right now, and while we don't want to be completely tied to it, I suspect it's a reason that at least some of you are listening. So a few things to say about this and some of the other polls this week since Trump's diagnosis and since the debate. There was also an NBC Wall Street Journal poll which showed a 14-point lead for Biden, and that's apparently the most lopsided poll, or ties the most lopsided poll of the 2016 race. In the 16-point lead that you mentioned, Will, where Biden's at 57% and Trump is at 41%, that's the most lopsided October poll that there's ever been in any election in the 21st century. Even in 2008, Obama never led McCain by more than 15 points throughout the race. If you average Biden's lead in the polls, according to Real Clear Politics, his lead averages to 9.2%. That's the biggest since late July. And it's also the biggest general election lead of any race this century, again, including 2008. Just finally, according to the Washington Post, there hasn't been a presidential race decided by 9 points or more since 84, which was the Reagan-Mondale election you alluded to. Obama won by 7 points. George H.W. Bush by 8 and Bill Clinton by 8.5 in an election that included Ross Perot. So a Trump victory is still plausible even with these results because of how undemocratic the Electoral College is. If Trump was able to win Ohio and Wisconsin and Iowa and Florida, Biden could swing Michigan and Pennsylvania and still narrowly lose the Electoral College. So despite the election looking like a foregone conclusion, I think it's still worth psychologically preparing yourself for both outcomes. But given Biden's lead in the polls, I do think it's worth saying a few things.
First of all, he doesn't need the left. That's the first thing that we've established.
Right. Well, actually, that gets to what I wanted to say, which is that, you know, Democrats are going to learn all of the deliberately, they're going to learn all of the wrong lessons for this, right? If even the 9.2% RCP average is borne out in national polls on election night, and, you know, the most likely Electoral College outcome occurs, which is Biden swinging Arizona and North Carolina, winning Wisconsin, obviously Ohio and Pennsylvania, the Electoral College is going to be incredibly lopsided. And they're going to take that as a vindication of their strategy. And they are very much going to conclude that they didn't need the left because they ran while openly antagonizing the left and won anyway. But it's important to underscore that what's really happening here is that the anti-Trump vote is consolidating around generic Democrat. Biden is running a horrible campaign that under normal circumstances would be doomed to failure. The Democrats took an enormous risk by consolidating around Biden. But because of COVID, because of record unemployment, and because Trump is being so unbelievably reckless and irresponsible and behaving so dangerously, none of that's going to matter. I mean, I think at this point they could literally sub in 92-year-old Walter Mondale and win. In fact, I'd put my chips on Mondale winning even bigger than Biden. I think the old dog still got some fire in the belly. But just on Trump very quickly, I think what's really doomed him, the record unemployment, the state of the economy, and the context of mass death, much of it preventable notwithstanding, is that he's adopted a strategy that basically doubles down on just kind of red meat Fox News culture war stuff. He's showing none of the, I don't want to use the word, it's weird to use the word dynamism in the context of Donald Trump, but he's none of the novelty that was present in his 2016 campaign is present this time around. He's not sounding those, you know, for want of a better word, populist notes that enabled him to swing just as, just enough voters in, you know, key counties of Ohio and Wisconsin and places like that last time. I had a really interesting conversation with the fellows from the Know Your Enemy podcast for an interview with Jacobin that's going to be coming out soon. And we talked about this a lot. I mean, just about how the machinery of the Republican Party under Trump has really prohibited them from doing the kinds of things that actually could have turned coronavirus into a historic opportunity for realignment, which, I mean, I think there was a really genuine fear momentarily on the left that the Republicans were going to do something like this, that they were going to, you know, embrace a really bold kind of welfarist agenda, that they might kind of, in certain respects, outflank the Democrats.
I remember us discussing that possibility on this very podcast.
Right. And obviously that didn't happen. And there are a number of reasons for that. But as Sam and Matt from Know Your Enemy told me, and I think they put this very well, in some respects, the Republican Party is basically, or, you know, what's called the conservative movement is sections of business, big and small, and, you know, right-wing evangelical Christians. And that's the Republican Party. And I do wonder if some of the machinery that allowed Trump to win in the first place, you know, the right-wing media ecosystem, which kind of exists independently of much of the media that the rest of the country consumes, I do wonder if those things may actually, ironically enough, contribute to Trump's downfall, because they created an incentive structure for him to just pander endlessly to an ever diminishing, you know, minority of like feral MAGA people and not do any of the things that, you know, enabled him to win last time. A friend of the show, Branko Marketich, I remember, said something a few weeks ago, which I thought was really on point, which is that Trump seems to have internalized a lot of the bad liberal explanations for why he won. He doesn't seem to get that he was actually able to win over people who voted for Barack Obama in key counties. He was able to win over voters who professed dislike of both candidates. He was able to harvest independent voters in a way that, you know, Mitt Romney, say, or somebody like that wasn't equipped to do. And while I, again, have to drop in the necessary caveat that we don't know what's going to happen on election day, if Trump does indeed go down to defeat in the way that the polls seem to be suggesting he will, it's going to be for all those reasons. Against such a weak opponent especially, defeat for Trump was not inevitable. And I guess the Democrats, and by extension the rest of us, are lucky that Trump is so unbelievably stupid and incompetent.
Well, there he goes, folks. The wounded Bernie bro strikes again. Doesn't know when he's been licked.
Well, you're joking, but I mean, that is fair. It's very hard, even with the knowledge that Trump may very certainly lose badly, it's very hard to feel like this is going to be anything other than a Pyrrhic victory. I mean, something that has consistently bothered me, and it gets especially bad always, you know, it did in 2016 as well, in kind of like August, September, October, as that kind of mainstream political discourse gets less and less good as the election draws to a close at basic intellectual honesty about the Democratic Party and the Democratic nominee. So in the past week, I feel like I've seen an uptick of people who should really know better. And I'm speaking mostly about Canadians who I follow, not people in the States, but people maybe in the sort of NDP orbit, on, you know, the kind of social democratic orbit in Canada, people like that. You know, I've seen this uptick in kind of this, you know, pretense that Biden and Harris, that their win will represent a victory for the left. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just feel the need to say the left lost the election in April. The election was over for the left then. You know, we obviously want Trump to be defeated, but there is every reason to believe that Biden will run his administration like he's run this campaign, which has involved a lot of open antagonizing of Bernie Sanders and the left, even as Bernie is literally out campaigning for him. Biden will warmly accept the endorsement of the architect of the Flint water crisis, but he's on CNN red baiting and talking about how he's never been a socialist and things like that. And that is, particularly if the Democratic margin of victory is a large one, I mean, that is going to be licensed to just cut any kind of left-wing influence out of a future Democratic administration. And so the battle, you know, in January, if Biden is elected president, really is going to be to fight the complacency which is going to set in, because Biden is fundamentally a tranquilizing figure. And so many people are going to want politics to just go away. Chances are, if politics do indeed go away and things are restored to quote unquote normalcy, you know, and all the celebs go back to brunch and all the rest of it, old Democratic reflexes from the Obama and I think even the Clinton era will quickly crystallize in the new administration. And you will see, you know, all the old guard, Larry Summers, you know, people like that, returned yet again for another kick at the can to do all the things that, you know, the Lewinsky scandal and the 2010 midterms didn't allow them to do. All that stuff from the summer about how Biden was going to be the next FDR is going to feel very alien very quickly.
And you know what? People's lives are going to keep getting better. All the problems are going to keep going away. And then you're just going to have to put your words on a plate and eat them, because folks, politics is going to be over. By way of getting into the movie this episode, I want to talk about something that's been bothering me very severely, a real issue facing Western democracy, and that is Saturday Night Live.
And we can all make America not actively on fire again. Okay. Now I'll unpause him.
Antifa!
Nope, can't do it. We'll leave him on pause.
Like you, I saw Jim Carrey make his much publicized debut as Joe Biden, and it bothered me for a couple of reasons. I find it a bit alienating, you know, a year after all of this discourse. I said something about this on the last episode, but all this discourse about what a bad guy Joe Biden is, how he was enabling segregationists, how he had his fingerprints on basically every ill that has plagued the United States for the last 50 years, whether it's mass incarceration or Wall Street deregulation or the Iraq War, you know, everything. There seemed to be a real discourse around this stuff. And now I see Jim Carrey playing Onion Joe Biden. The debate looked nothing like that. It's not even, I see stuff like that and I feel like I'm going insane, you know? I understand that there are a multitude of realities that we're all living in.
No, but Will, you just need to open up your third eye, which is, or maybe it's your fourth eye, whatever eye is like the normie lib one, where there exists a parallel dimension that isn't reality, but is in fact a more real reality. Because I think for the, you know, MSNBC liberals who find this funny, what they saw on the SNL skit is more real than the actual debate.
It's fan fiction, right? Right. It's how they want the debate to be. In fact, the sketch even has a bit in it where, like, Joe Biden pauses Trump and talks about how nice it is to pause him, right? So that's the fan fiction element of it. There weren't a lot of laughs in it, you'll notice. The audience was mostly just applauding.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter. It's not a problem for SNL ever that the, you know, often the people playing these real life figures don't make any effort to look or sound like them or to kind of emulate their mannerisms or anything like that. But in its own way, I guess you can credit Carrey's performance with it. You know, it does capture what the appeal of Joe Biden is for liberals, which has nothing to do with the man or his record or his politics or his campaign, which isn't really running on anything. There's really no message of any kind except what Carrey says in this sketch, which is, isn't that nice? 5 seconds of Trumplessness. He says, vote for me and we'll make America not actively on fire again. You mentioned the Diamond Joe character, And that is, you know, this is it. This is the Biden campaign in a nutshell. Its only promise and its only appeal, which is a very strong one for a great many people, is let's get back things back to like 2014. Because things were fine then. So I guess in that sense, we can credit Kerry's performance. Although I guess I should say, yeah, it is resoundingly unfunny and also terrible.
The other thing that bothers me about it on a very deep and I think even existential level is the fact that this show, Saturday Night Live, has traditionally been where the next generation of comedy stars is discovered. And now it has become this playground where the stars of 25 years ago, literally 25 years ago in Jim Carrey's case, that's when he was the hottest comedy star in America, they come on and they play dress up. And that to me seems symbolic of a nation in decline, don't you think? Doesn't that seem like a failed state somehow, where the launch pad show becomes where all of these people regress to, because there is now nowhere to go beyond that? The launch pad show is now the closest thing to like a shared communal monoculture experience that we still have, because everything else has been totally atomized and, well, especially under the pandemic, just like destroyed. I don't see how this is sustainable.
It is strangely emblematic of just how gilded and oligarchic everything in the United States is. That this thing, which was originally a kind of meritocratic institution, if you're funny and you got some talent, you know, you can make it on the show. And a lot of, you know, famous comedians in the 90s obviously got their start on Saturday Night Live. But now a role on Saturday Night Live is proprietary to people who are already, it's the inheritance of people who are already famous, because fame and prestige and money and the other things that belong to you if you're a part of the political or cultural or economic ruling class, those are the prerequisites. That's the buy-in now. That's how high the bar is. Meritocracy now being even more of a sham than it was, you know, 20 or 30 years ago.
But it seems unsustainable to me, because I think the appeal of SNL to those who find it appealing is that excitement of seeing an energetic new talent, you know, seeing a young Eddie Murphy, seeing a young Chris Farley,
a young Dana Carvey portraying George H.W. Bush,
a young, I don't know, John Belushi, you know, who are the great like breakout SNL stars. You know, there was a force of nature. There was something in those stars that people had never seen before. And when I see Jim Carrey playing Joe Biden, he is literally just playing Fire Marshal Bill. It's just Fire Marshal Bill with a new haircut. Nobody's laughing at it because we've seen every trick in his toolbox. He has nothing left to surprise us. We've seen every dimension of this man's talent over the last, not even 25, the last 35 years. And surely this has got to come crashing down at some point, right? It can't run on fumes forever.
Now, did you watch the clip where it's Kerry as Biden and then who's the actress that's...
Maya Rudolph as Kamala
Maya Harris. Rudolph? Did you see that?
Yeah, I did. I did.
So I can't remember who said it, but somebody made a really prescient comment.
It was Bronco, in fact, who said
it. Oh, right. Yeah. So we're citing Bronco, repeat guest Bronco once again. But yeah, he made the point that we can discern how liberals will cast the Biden administration, which is very much a reboot of the Diamond Joe character with Kamala Harris added on. So Kamala Harris is the adult who's, you know, really running things, and Biden is the doddering grandpa, and all of the crazy stuff that he'll do if he gets elected president is going to be recast as kind of cute and avuncular and endearing. And yikes, I'm afraid that's what we're in for, folks.
But, you know, there was a time before Jim Carrey was a deflated, hollowed out husk of his former self. There was a time when he was the biggest movie star in the world. And when you are suddenly propelled to being the biggest movie star in the world, it does things to your brain. This week, we watched the 2017 documentary Jim and Andy, The Great Beyond, about Carrey's method performance as Andy Kaufman in the film Man on the Moon.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jim Carrey, and how are you this evening? Alrighty then.
Finding out you have something special and it gets a reaction. That's how I got attention and love.
I watched the stars fall silent from you.
Andy Kaufman came in to turn reality on its head and not stop when the camera stopped.
You, Europe!
Andy Kaufman cared less about making his audience laugh than keeping them confused.
He blew my mind. When I heard I had the part, I was looking at the ocean, and that's the moment when Andy came back to make his movie.
Hello.
What happened after was out of my control.
Andy, that's enough, Wilfred.
I don't like it. I want to do one more.
Andy felt it was necessary to stay in the character.
He's exactly the way Andy was.
It's totally surreal.
And this crazy melodrama started happening all over the place.
Weirdly enough, I don't think we've ever talked about Jim Carrey on the podcast, which is a glaring oversight on both of our parts, because as children of the 1990s, and particularly as young boys in the 1990s, Jim Carrey, along with, you know, Adam Sandler, who else am I missing?
Well, I was a big fan of Ernest. You remember Ernest, Jim Varney?
I must have watched almost every Jim Carrey movie. I mean, certainly all the 90s ones I saw, I watched them multiple times.
Ace Ventura, I probably saw 50 times.
I mean, The Mask. I used to know that whole, you know, when he sings the
They Call Me Cuban Pete. Yeah.
I might be able to still, I'm not going to demonstrate on the show because I'm too self-conscious, but I could probably do that whole thing from memory still to this day. Liar Liar, I watched that over and over again. I feel like we should do Liar Liar at some point, because I feel like it's one of those other movies that affirms my thesis about the 1990s, which is that every movie is just about divorce, especially every kids movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, that movie is literally about divorce. But I'm convinced that even movies that aren't about divorce, like Jurassic Park, are actually about divorce. Anyway, that's a subject for another episode.
There are a lot of 90s movies about, like, threats to the family unit, for sure. Like Jurassic Park or Mrs. Doubtfire.
I guess it's technically from the 80s, but True Lies were the threat to the family unit.
No, that's from the 90s. It falls straight from the 90s. Within your thesis, yeah.
Where the threat to the American nuclear family is like generic Arab terrorists or whatever. And it turns out the reason why Arnold is a bad father is actually because he's so alpha that he's working for the national security state to arrest threats against every American family and stop them in their tracks with high-powered weaponry.
We should do that movie, actually. But yeah, what was it about Jim Carrey that you think, I don't know, resonated at that time, both with us and with the culture at large?
I don't think I have anything insightful to say about why Jim Carrey was resonant in the culture at large, but I can definitely say why he resonated with me, which is just that when you're a kid, I mean, he really appeals to your sense of humor. I mean, especially if you're, I mean, I feel like this is probably somewhat gender specific, but his comedy was just kind of physically uninhibited. He just made goofy noises and things like that. And as like a 7-year-old, I found that extremely funny. I'm not sure there's much more to it than that.
One of the strange things about Jim Carrey is he was a direct descendant of and was often compared to Jerry Lewis, who kind of set a precedent for somebody who was that wacky and that manic. But the key differences are that Jerry Lewis, as a screen presence, he was very nerdy. He was, in fact, I think quite desexualized on screen. Maybe you could debate that a little bit, but like Jim Carrey as Ace Ventura was, I think, unambiguously macho.
Do you remember in Ace Ventura where, and you know, I suspect this would watch very strangely now, he just takes Courtney Cox home? Like, they just put that in the movie for no reason. They're like, oh yeah, they sleep together. And then there's a scene, I almost wonder if after watching this Andy Kaufman thing, if Carrie didn't like request for this to be put in, but they write the scene so that, you know, it turns out that Ace Ventura is like an absolute dynamo in the sack. And she's going like, you know, oh my God, 3 times. And he's like, okay, I'm ready again.
That is a weird scene. And it's very deliberately placed because there's something about that scene that says, okay, yeah, he's a nature lover. He's an animal lover. But, you know, he's not a nerd. He's not one of those loser vegetarian types. You know, he's not one of those animal rights downers. Like this guy fucks, you know?
Yeah, he's a nature lover in the carnal sense.
Jonathan Rosenbaum wrote an essay about Ace Ventura a couple weeks after it came out. Like most critics, he didn't like the movie, and Ace Ventura was very much a surprise success when it came out. He was trying to figure out why it was that kids in particular reacted to the movie so much. He compares him to Andrew Dice Clay, who was also a kind of popular comedian at the time, but was on the way out. Andrew Dice Clay being a very kind of macho, the exemplar of what would now be called toxic masculinity. He wrote, Jim Carrey resembles Andrew Dice Clay, and Ventura resembles Clay's character Ford Fairlane. So why is it that the adventures of Ford Fairlane flopped and Ace Ventura hasn't? The difference in response may be partly demographic, related to both age and political orientation. Both detectives are depicted as godlike superstuds, but Clay's Fairlane seems to belong to the Rush Limbaugh camp, not exactly a preteen constituency, while Carrie's Ventura, who seems to own as vast a collection of unbuttoned Hawaiian shirts as James Woods in Salvador, may be said to embody Oliver Stone's idea of a macho progressive. Rosenbaum goes on to talk a little bit about how Ace Ventura positions himself as kind of an enemy of the adult world. He aligns himself with the animal world, and kids can feel a sort of affinity for that. Something that Rosenbaum didn't get into at the time, and which frankly very few people have gotten into about this movie until recently, at least in the mainstream press, is how incredibly transphobic it is. I watched Ace Ventura Pet Detective again this summer, and that climactic scene where he's basically stripping Sean Young in front of the whole police force and humiliating her, I mean, it's really hard to watch. It's really despicable. And it's interesting that it comes towards the end of a movie where Ace Ventura is positioning himself as, yeah, this like enemy of polite society, you know, this enemy of not just the adult world, but the human world. He aligns himself more with the animals than with people. But when it comes to any kind of sexual ambiguity or any kind of gender diversity, no way. He is straight as an arrow, and he has nothing but contempt for anything that isn't.
Yeah, it's pretty ugly, that scene. I mean, it's also worth saying that, I mean, the premise of that movie is absolutely ridiculous.
Oh my God.
And I don't think I quite understood as a kid how ridiculous it is. What this movie asks us to believe is that Ray Finkel is so angry at Dan Marino for holding the ball wrong during a crucial Super Bowl kick that he has gone undercover and replaced a female cop and then risen to the top of the Miami Police Department. Not the Duluth Police Department, not some rinky-dinky police department in the Midwest, the Miami Police Department, and this is all part of an elaborate revenge plot.
Can I also add how funny it is that the Super Bowl halftime show that year is Dolphin Tricks, and the dolphin has been kidnapped, 2 weeks before the Super Bowl, and the Miami Police Department is not even remotely concerned about this. They're like...
Whereas the Miami Dolphins are sent into a spiritual crisis.
The police department is like, you know, we have serious cases like murders and burglaries. We're not worried about a missing dolphin. But you would think the National Football League would have some lobbying power over the Miami Police Department to put their best men on this case. And also, you think that the Super Bowl would have a higher wattage halftime show, like, I don't know, the Rolling Stones, maybe?
Do you think there's any Jim Carrey movies from the 90s that actually hold up? Because I think that it's been a few years since I've watched Dumb and Dumber, but I still think that might be one of the funniest movies of all time.
I watched Dumb and Dumber recently, and it's very funny. You know, Ace Ventura has a lot of laughs in it, too, until it becomes the birth of a nation of transphobia in the last third.
You know what's incredible about Dumb and Dumber is, I mean, if we're not careful, we'll just do every riff from Dumb and Dumber, but...
Oh, big gulps, eh? All right.
I mean, there's the Mockingbird part. There's so many memorable bits. I think the thing that I remember most, which is just absolutely hysterical and speaks to how many layers of meta comedy and like anti-comedy there are in that film, is when is he Harry or Lloyd? Jim Carrey's Lloyd.
He's
right?
Lloyd, yeah.
When he's imagining what it's going to be like in Aspen when you know, he seduces, is it Mary?
Mary Swanson or something?
When he seduces Mary Swanson, when, you know, when he brings her the briefcase, and he's imagining himself at the top of, like, Aspen High Society, but then the jokes he's telling are just, like, the same ones. And his big, like, showstopper for the night is lighting his own fart on fire. And this is so funny. It's like, in his fantasy, he doesn't, like, revise himself to be, like, more find or whatever. It's like he's still farting and lighting it on fire.
I do think at least moments of those Jim Carrey movies hold up, because I do think his talent was pretty undeniable. And you know, the movie that we watched this week, Jim and Andy, which is a horrifying movie in many ways, it's weird, like, as I was watching it, I found myself being like pretty amused and entertained throughout, because it's, you know, it's, he's being a complete prick, but it is footage of golden age Jim Carrey, you know, cavorting and doing shenanigans, and the man was pretty talented. I don't know if you had that same reaction. It's like, in a weird way, Jim and Andy like works as a Jim Carrey comedy for me.
Yeah, I guess I can see that. I guess I'm kind of removed from the period in my life where I was thinking about Jim Carrey. So it was kind of a little weird to revisit. I mean, the other thing is Man on the Moon and The Truman Show, that era of Jim Carrey, which I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that like the early 2000s, sort of Bruce Almighty?
There was definitely the period where he was trying to transition into being a dramatic actor, and Truman Show and Man on the Moon were the big stabs. I think Man on the Moon came out in 99.
I distinctly remember renting that from Blockbuster, which was, you know, the only place you could get movies in the 90s. You know, watching it and being, you know, really disappointed because I didn't really get, like, it didn't compute for me. It, like, this is Jim Carrey, but it's not really a comedy. And then, you know, he dies at the end. And that was really sad. And the same thing happened with The Truman Show. There's only one moment in The Truman Show where he does, like, the Jim Carrey voice, you know, where it's when he's realizing that, you know, he's inside of a TV show. He pretends to drive away from a certain neighborhood, and then he drives back and all the traffic has gone away because they think he's not going to be there. And he's like, it's unbelievable, or something like that. And I laughed as a whatever 12-year-old at that. But I was so disappointed by the rest of the movie. And so revisiting Man on the Moon, it wasn't for me like revisiting Jim Carrey from, you know, The Mask or Liar Liar or something like that. It was like revisiting my most anticlimactic experience with Jim Carrey towards the tail end of, you know, my Jim Carrey phase.
So when you saw Man on the Moon as a kid, did you cotton on to the fact that it was a biopic of a real man named Andy Kaufman?
I knew what it was, but I didn't know anything about Andy Kaufman, and I just expected it to be a Jim Carrey movie. Like, I guess I'd seen so few films as a kid that a Jim Carrey movie, like, that's a genre. Mm-hmm. Like, Adam Sandler movie is a genre when you're, you know, an 8-year-old boy in the 90s. So it didn't seem right. There seemed to be something off about it. And I remember being very disappointed.
I see, because I, of course, being a child, didn't know much or anything about Andy Kaufman before seeing it. And I found the movie very intriguing. I found the idea of Andy Kaufman very intriguing, particularly that bit where he's on Saturday Night Live and it's the Mighty Mouse record where he's just standing next to the record and then in the chorus he'll start lip syncing it and then he'll stop. I mean, as a kid, that was kind of a mind-blowing thing. I looked at it and I thought, how can that be comedy? How does that qualify as comedy? And trying to kind of wrap my head around it, I imagine that people might have had a similar reaction when they saw an Andy Warhol soup can for the first time, or like a Marcel Duchamp's urinal that he signed and put in a gallery. Like, this very aggressive challenge to the idea of what constitutes the art form. And so I found, you know, as a kid, I very much liked Man on the Moon, and I was very intrigued by this figure of Andy Kaufman. And, you know, nowadays I'm probably much more interested in Andy Kaufman than I am in Jim Carrey.
Jimmy said they came down hard.
Who's they?
Universal didn't want the footage we took behind the scenes to surface so that people wouldn't think I was an asshole.
Andy, you have to give me a chance to make a movie.
I don't need to make a movie. I don't need to make a movie.
I was thinking, how far should I take this?
So for people who haven't seen this movie, I mean, it's not as if there's really a plot to recount or anything like that. I mean, if I was to offer the most concise summary I could, I would say that the foreground of this film is an interview with 2017 Jim Carrey, who has donned a leather jacket and has a kind of
a David Letterman beard, if you will.
Yeah, a wise grayness, an erudite grayness has crept into his beard. And it sort of cuts between this and the footage from him refusing to break character as Andy Kaufman.
Footage shot behind the scenes of Man on the Moon. And in fact, it seems that Jim Carrey has employed a film crew of his own to follow him around during the making of this film, capturing his artistic process, capturing this extraordinary transformation where he became Andy Kaufman. By which I mean he insisted that he was Andy Kaufman, insisted everyone refer to him, insisted that he was being imbued with the spirit of the real long-dead Andy Kaufman and behaving how he thought Andy Kaufman would behave, which is probably not how he actually would have behaved. I'm just going to suggest.
Yeah, and it's great because he is genuinely pissing off people on the set, just acting like a total asshole. Milos Forman, the director, has kind of tried to strike a peace with him. You know, he has kind of nervous detente with him where he agrees to address him as Andy, but then he says stuff like, you know, please, you have to meet me halfway. It's time to work. You have to let me make a movie. But the basic structure of the film is just Carrey saying stuff like, I wanted to be special. I wanted to be someone, you know, and I knew that I had this spark within me. And then just cutting to him as Andy Kaufman being like, me, 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 or whatever, or because that's what Jim Carrey did. And it's a pretty funny contrast.
I enjoyed this documentary very much, mostly for the footage that was captured on the set of the movie. I think the case can be made that this documentary, Jim and Andy, is a little bit too indulgent of Jim Carrey, particularly in his present-day interviews, where he strikes a very kind of new-agey tone, where he's constantly saying things like, well, there is no me, you know, the bullshit pseudo-philosophical garbage, and talking very coyly and in very twee fashion about his artistic journey, saying, well, it seems like Andy got into some real mischief on the set that day. I don't know, I wasn't there. Andy was there. You'll have to talk to him, you know, that kind of stuff. The case could be made that the movie is too indulgent of Carrey throughout all that, but I think the footage speaks for itself. I think it is an amazing behind-the-scenes document of a man who has let fame completely rot his brain, a man for whom fame has destroyed any sense of boundary, any sense of humility, and has destroyed anybody else's ability to challenge him or rein him in. You know, he's on the set with Academy Award-winning director Milos Forman. Milos Forman basically has to beg him to get him to do anything. And, I mean, I don't know if people have seen Man on the Moon recently. I think Jim Carrey is quite bad in it. I think it's a very mannered performance. And watching this documentary, I think how much better he would have been had he let Milos Forman direct him. It's an actor who basically wants to think that he did the whole thing himself. He wants to think that this performance he gave was God-granted, that it emerged fully formed. But great actors don't actually do it that way. Great actors are collaborative. You know, they consult with their directors. They consult with their supporting actors. You know, they bounce around ideas.
You know what I like is the clip where Carrey was on Oprah Winfrey, and he's talking, I guess this was sometime in the 90s, and he's talking about how in his process for success in life is that he visualizes something and then it happens. And he's like, I wrote myself a check for $10 million. And then a few years later, you know, I had $10 million. And it's great because despite all his new agey pretension in this movie, he just sounds like a success win guy here. Like, he sounds like just the most like snake oil self-help guru, you know, that's just telling you like to visualize what you want your life to be and then just like write that down every day until it happens. He has the kind of superficial evangelical conviction of somebody who attended like an Anthony Robbins seminar, except it's the free one by the airport, you know, that's just the trial before you pay for the course. And has taken it on board as a kind of instant revelation. The thing that was, I think, accidentally funny about this movie for me is just the contrast between the Jim Carrey that you see in all the clips from the 90s and filming Man on the Moon and the Jim Carrey in the interview, because what he's saying in the interview is all this stuff that's just like
hokum.
Yeah, all this kind of faux philosophical hokum where he's like, you know, you just got to take a chance on whether you want to be loved or hated or, you know, to kill a part of yourself. You know, there are these abstract structures that are designed to keep you grounded. And some time ago, I just decided that I didn't need those. I was just going to let them go. I was going to fly at 6,000 miles an hour. I was going to float on the tectonic plates atop the lava. And I was just going to see where life takes me, you know, because we're all going to the same place, or hey, maybe this is all there is, you know. And he's talking about this stuff, you know, cuts between that and then like just like him farting or whatever, and you know, he's talking about this stuff with like a gravitas that makes it sound like he's describing, you know, the act of committing heresy in 12th century Constantinople, rather than him being a guy who has become a millionaire many times over from doing a butt voice or whatever.
Wasn't it funny at the end of the documentary when he talks about emerging from the Andy Kaufman role, going back to his life after making the movie and discovering that all his old problems were still there, and that immersing himself in Andy Kaufman was really, it turns out, really just a distraction from those problems. It wasn't the artistic spiritual rebirth that he thought it would be. I suppose it's a fairly predictable outcome. It's funny too, coming at the end of a movie where, like, this documentary and Carey himself positions the making of Man on the Moon as strictly an artistic journey for Jim Carrey. There's kind of no consideration of what it means for anybody else involved in the making of the movie. Miloš Forman, the ostensible director of the film, is such an incidental character. You know, he looks like somebody who's just like barely keeping it together.
A much more interesting artistic force than Jim Carrey.
The case could be made for sure. Carrey's kind of not only denying everybody else the chance to have their own artistic journey, like when Jerry Lawler, the wrestler who Andy Kaufman collaborated with in real life, comes to the set. Kaufman and Lawler had a famous, like, fake feud that would run in various media for a couple of years, culminating with a famous appearance on the David Letterman show. They were apparently actually very good friends in real life and would consult with each other and hatch their schemes together. But Carrey keeps insisting on antagonizing Jerry Lawler whenever he's on the set, throwing things at him, taunting him, verbally abusing him, to the point where Lawler is provoked to actually, like, start a fight with Jim Carrey.
Yeah, he's like shaking the trailer and throwing chairs at it and stuff.
Fame has rotted Carrey's brain to such a degree that he thinks that, like, this is clearly my artistic journey and everybody will eventually be happy in the long run. Even if I'm antagonizing them now, they'll be happy in the long run to have contributed to this artistic journey of mine.
I mean, Andy was really a sweet, humble guy, loved the wrestling business. And he was so great at what he did when he was on the shows. I mean, he just made the people despise him. He was so good at playing the bad guy. And that's the way Andy described it. He said, I love to play the bad guy. Then when we did the movie with Jim Carrey, and that's how this whole Netflix movie came about. For 80 days of shooting that movie at Universal, Jim Carrey became, or in his mind, he became Andy Kaufman. Except he wasn't, maybe he was, I don't know. I don't know if he was, you'll understand it more when you see the movie. I guess to him, he was playing the bad guy, but to everyone else around him, he was just being a bad guy. And so I didn't really get along with Jim Carrey all during the shooting of the movie. I didn't like Jim Carrey. I didn't even realize that all of this behind the scenes footage was even being shot at the time.
You know, I remember when Man on the Moon came out and all of this stuff, I mean, the footage that we see in this documentary wasn't available, but it was widely known and widely publicized that Carrey had insisted on living life as Andy Kaufman and having everybody address him that way, and had insisted on taking on the persona of Tony Clifton as well when he was on the set. And this was all part of, you know, the Oscar campaign. This was all part of showing what a dedicated actor he was. And, you know, you see it in this documentary and it's like a parody of a method actor. And it seems like method acting, that kind of extreme actor behavior, has really gone out of fashion in recent years. It's been very much linked to, let's use that phrase again, toxic masculinity. You know, it's something that's always brought up with regards to kind of like egocentric male actors who use it to justify terrorizing their coworkers. You know, the stuff with Marlon Brando on the set of Last Tango in Paris gets brought up on social media at least once every 6 months. There's a new discourse cycle around that. It seems to me that method acting, or at least a certain conception of method acting, really went out of fashion when Jared Leto did some very Jim Carrey-ish behavior on the set of Suicide Squad.
I mean, unless I'm mistaken, I don't think that has anything to do with the toxic masculinity argument. It's just because it was so embarrassing in Jared Leto's hands. There's that interview where he's talking about it so seriously, and he's like, and it's like, Leto committed to never breaking character on set. And he talks about, like, walking around Toronto, I guess, where they were shooting, just like practicing the laugh and seeing how people reacted and stuff.
But he would also do things like he famously sent used condoms to some of his co-stars, like in a box. And he would say, you know, from the Joker, you know, to keep them on edge.
Yeah, I guess that's pretty gross. But it's like, if anything discredited that, it's that there was so much hype around that movie, and specifically the publicity campaign really played up the Joker angle. It's like, there's a new Joker and it's going to be even scarier than the Heath Ledger Joker. It's going to be the scariest Joker ever. And then when the movie came out, it had been recut and he's in it for about 10 minutes. And it looks like they're using B-roll footage half the time. And, you know, most of his job in the movie is just going like, this is what we were told was the, you know, career-defining, character-defining performance that the ancient art of method acting had unlocked.
Oof, I'm getting spooked just thinking about it. But it seems to me that ever since particularly Me Too, there's been this backlash to kind of, particularly in movies, like extreme artistic behavior. You know, directors who like terrorize their actors or put their actors through difficult conditions to get that perfect image, or tough method actors who terrorize their coworkers all in the pursuit of truth. All of that seems to have gone out of fashion very decisively and very suddenly. And it's interesting to me just because that's all stuff that I feel like I kind of grew up with and was always around. And it seemed like there was so much agreement that that stuff was cool, you know, particularly in like cinephile circles. And I'm not saying that it actually was or that it actually was right, but the sudden shift.
Well, if your childhood self is yearning for that to return, fear not, because Joe Biden is probably going to win the presidential election. And if there was ever a figure to lay waste to the liberal cultural ecosystem of the past, you know, 4 or 5 years, it would be that guy. So method acting's back. And we may even get to see, in Persona-like fashion, Jim Carrey refuse to break character as Joe Biden.
That's so funny.
I can see it now. Feral Jim Carrey roaming around the streets of Wilmington, Delaware, riding the Amtrak to DC, wearing a pair of Oakleys and just antagonizing everyone, insisting that they call him Joe.
Now watch this drive.
Close our eyes and sleep sweet dreams.